Leslie Healy is a longtime Beatles fan who, as a teen in New York City, saw the Beatles taping one of their original appearances on Ed Sullivan, and she hasn't really been the same since. In the mid-60s, she even made a pilgrimage to England and wound up meeting each of the four Beatles, actually spending some quality time with each. Now she's writing a book about her lifetime devotion to the band, and she joins us from Foster Communication Studios near her home in San Angelo, Texas. Hello, Leslie.
Hi, how are you, Paul?
Great. Thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure.
So, Leslie, what do you recall about your first impressions of Revolver when it came out in the summer of 1966?
I think what I remember most about it, hearing it, you know, as a new album, was how different and what different directions the different, well, especially John, Paul, and George were going, because they all were doing their songwriting, and it really wasn't the She Loves You, Hard Day's Night foursome. It was separate, individual people going in four different directions.
So when you say the She Loves You, Hard Day's Night foursome, that also makes me think of the fact that this album especially, well, every album before this one, was essentially almost entirely about boy-girl romance. And I'm wondering if you could comment a little bit on what I hear you saying is sort of a shift in lyrical content here.
Well, they're different directions. You can see pretty clearly that John was heavily into drugs. I mean, he was in his own world. When you look at Tomorrow Never Knows, he was doing from the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and he was just putting tape loops together and just a whole different direction. You couldn't say that was one of the four happy mop-top lads. Same again, I'm Only Sleeping. It's a pretty hazy song. I mean, musically, it was very interesting, but it wasn't the mop-tops that we saw in 64 and 65.
So as the Beatles moved through their various phases of sounds and looks, and this particular dramatic one with the release of Revolver, did you ever hesitate in your devotion to them? And if you can start this answer out, since I probably won't use my questions, you know, with like when Revolver came out or something like that.
Well, when Revolver came out, I was just going to be a senior in high school, and I was looking towards when I can go over to England and meet the Beatles. And my whole focus, I was this crazy Beatle fan in New York, and I was trying to learn guitar and listen to George playing guitar and just take in all of their music. And so I think, like what you do with watermelon, you eat what you like, you eat the meat, and you spit out the seeds. So the lyrical songs, which were, you know, the Paul songs and some of the George songs, I loved. But then some of the little more way out songs, it's like, where are we going here?
So you were a little perplexed by some of the content. Huh?
Yeah, because I was this young kid of 16, and I mean, drugs weren't in my scene. And you knew because you started hearing about, you know, Beatles are going into drugs and LSD and, you know, that scene. It's like, that's not where I was at.
So let's talk about specific songs on the album that you like. And, you know, you don't have to name everyone, but I'm wondering if you would pick maybe three or four and just, and don't treat them like a list. Treat them one at a time, but just say something like, this particular track, name the track, what I particularly like about it is, and let's just go through and
sure.
Let you talk about some.
Sure. Well, for the first time, there were three George Harrison songs on an album, because John and Paul, their songwriting has dominated. But when you have Taxman and I Want to Tell You and Love You Too in one album, it showed how talented George was, not only musically, but his lyrics. When you look at Taxman, that song holds today every April. You know, if you drive too quick, I'll tax your feet. And remember Mr. Wilson and Mr. Heath, who were mentioned in Taxman. And actually, it was Prime Minister Harold Wilson who, in 1965, gave them their MBEs. So I think that's pretty poignant. And then when you look at George's Love to You, that's the first time he really went into the Indian music and opened a lot of people's eyes into Eastern music and the Ravi Shankar scene and different melodies and different harmonics. Very, very special to me because I grew up and I was a George fan. And then you can look at Paul's writing. Paul's writing a whole bunch of love songs. I mean, Eleanor Rigby, how beautiful. It's like another yesterday. And here, there, and everywhere, is that not the ultimate love song where you see your lover here, there, and everywhere? And then to cap it all, Good Day Sunshine. And just as a side note, at the end of last year, my husband and I got to see Paul McCartney in concert, and Sir Paul gave the whole background of Good Day Sunshine, of how it had been linked up to the shuttle coming down, and they were awoken one day when they were going to be able to land in the good weather with Good Day Sunshine, and it was absolutely an awesome experience. Now I can't get that song out of my mind.
What? Let's talk about that song a little bit more, if you can.
Sure.
What makes it catchy or fun or memorable for you?
Boy, that's a tough question. Good Day Sunshine is really a happy song, and it's upbeat, and I guess I'm an optimist. The harmonies on there are awesome. It's Paul at his purest singing a love song, and then the harmonic, I guess the word is harmonics, the harmonics when he goes in the end and repeats Good Day Sunshine and it goes up a beat, it just sticks on me. It's one of those songs that reverberates. It's just a very optimistic song.
Right. Any other titles that you wanted to single out?
Well, something that's very interesting, you look at the English recording. I don't know if you're going into this or not, but you have the English recording, you have the American recording. We had 11 tracks. The English recording had 3 extras. It had I'm Only Sleeping and Dr. Robert and Your Bird Can Sing. And again, looking at the Dr. Robert and Anya Bird Can Sing, John's going somewhere. And there's one other really poignant bit where I think this is a painful album for John. John wasn't in his best, I don't think. He's going in negative in much more ways than the happy-go-lucky foursome that I said earlier. She said, you can hear the turmoil coming out of that song, and I think he's probably depressed there. I don't know where his marriage was in 66, but it sounds like he's really having a hard time in fighting through life. Just very, very sad.
Right. And remind me, your trip happened, was it 67, before Sgt. Pepper came out?
No, it was right after Sgt. Pepper. I left the States the end of June of 67. And I met them all the first week of July and many times after that.
Yeah. Yeah. And also the other big news about around the release of Revolver, it happened the very same week that all this brouhaha happened, the flap over John Lennon's Bigger Than Jesus remarks were publicized. Do you recall your own reaction to that or any of the fallout, the boycotts and burnings of Beatles stuff in the South? Did that reach your consciousness as a teenager?
It was in all the newspapers. It absolutely reached our consciousness. And if you looked a little bit deeper into it, the situation was, I believe, that John was misquoted by a Maureen Cleave article, or actually the Maureen Cleave article gave the whole story, and then some of the media picked out bits of it and took his phrase, "We're bigger than Jesus," out of context. And there was a big brouhaha. I wasn't living in the Southern Bible Belt then. I'm sure there was much more reaction here. At the time, it was just another news story, people, I think, getting at the Beatles. And to be honest, I'm a Christian now. I wasn't at the time. And what John had said, that we're bigger in popularity than the Beatles, than Christ, is probably true. But it was in a whole different sense. In the 1960s, I don't think there was a lot of Christianity in the pop music world, and the kids who were doing pop music probably weren't churchgoers.
Mm. Yeah, so in retrospect, you kind of understand where he was going.
If you read the whole story and the Maureen Cleave interviews, I believe were in the London Times, and I did get a copy of it, you know, pretty quick after it was published, because when you're a Beatles fan, you did stuff like getting all the English papers, and I did stuff like that. And you read the whole story, and it wasn't anything wrong that he said. And I don't believe he didn't mean to hurt Christians. I don't think he meant to stick his foot in his mouth. It was that it was taken out of context, which is a shame.
Right. What do you remember about your reaction to the album cover? Because, you know, Beatles fans, you enjoyed the music, but the whole presentation, it was part of the package. And I'm wondering if you, when you saw that for the first time, you know, what did you think?
Well, it was the first album that it didn't have the Beatles on it. I don't think it had the name The Beatles on the front at all. And we knew Klaus Voormann was the artist from Hamburg, who eventually did, I believe, bass work with Manfred Mann. It was very different. Again, it shows they were going somewheres. You know, they weren't just staying the same, the little cuddly foursome. I believe I read somewheres that when George Martin started doing this album, Paul, his instructions were think symphonic. And as we know, there's a lot more instruments and just new innovative ideas and different sounds on the album.
What do you think when you think about that album cover? Is it metaphoric in any way for you in terms of where the Beatles were at that time?
It was a change. It was certainly a change. It was different. Again, they were growing, and we were growing as well. We were in different places. But it sure is different when you look at Sgt. Pepper, which is, you know, overboard with a lot of different people, and this was, you know, very stark black and white, you know, not the psychedelic or the colors or anything that you'd probably expect more on an album. But then the Beatles were innovators. They could do whatever they wanted, and you'd still buy the record because it was the Beatles.
Yeah. But one thing that strikes me about the image, though, is this, just the sense that stuff's coming out of their head.
Yeah, you know? You're right.
And if you think about Revolver in terms of, you know, what the kind of transition it was, it really was sort of, you know, an explosion of, you know, what was going on in their heads at the time.
Sounds right. Absolutely. I agree with you. It was growing, and as you say, they were coming out in different directions. And again, Revolver, what does Revolver do? It shoots out in different directions, I guess.
Yeah, you know, I'd read, that has multiple meanings, but I'd read that they're idea for it was not the gun idea, but the kind of revolutions of the album itself.
The little black disc that ran around and around in a circle.
Right, 33 1/3 revolutions per minute.
Yes, of course.
Right.
And people today would say, "What's that? What do you do with
talking
it?"
Talking about, yeah.
Little black disc.
Yeah. Well, okay. Last call then, Leslie. On any things that you thought about as you've been preparing for this that have to do with Revolver, either songs or ideas that you think relate specifically to this particular moment in Beatle history?
Well, something that just sort of jumped out at me was the juxtaposition of the love songs versus where John was coming from, which was sort of going out, if you want to say underground or maybe getting a little bit into his LSD, and you could feel John's hurt versus Paul's love. And to me, that came out real clear.
But when the record came out, I mean, sort of the acknowledgement of the drug connection is something that happened in retrospect, so it wasn't something that was clearly evident at the time when you first put the record on the turntable, was it really?
It sounded like something was going on. It really sounded like they were moving in different directions, and where John was going, the depression and the hurt, came from somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, so you
I think at the time we really thought they were just, you know, maybe smoking marijuana. And of course, we found out later, as you say, with Dr. Robert, that he was their pusher or their dealer. You know, and that was really a real drug song.
Right, so what I'm picking up from you, though, is that there was definitely some sort of palpable change that might have even like concerned you or something at the time. I mean, when you were listening to these songs, were you thinking, gee, John sounds...
Yes, I really felt that. What's going on? I wonder what really is going on in his mind to write such painful songs. I think John's songs on Revolver showed he was going through a lot of turmoil, a lot of pain, a lot of experiments. And this came out in his music very, very, very clearly.